My stomach grumbles for its breakfast. I wonder how long it takes to die of hunger. I wonder if it hurts. The men continue to argue. Some think we'll be able to trade with the Indians, and others insist that the Indians will not trade now in midwinter, when they are probably going half-hungry themselves. Many want to kill the gentleman, or die trying. Reverend Hunt is standing near me. He is staring out at the ship, his face set in grim lines. "Is it all lost, Reverend?" I ask him. "Are we doomed?" He puts his hand on my shoulder.
"Do you see any wind?"
he asks. I take a good look at the surface of the river. There's hardly a ripple. I shake my head.
"Then the Discovery is not going anywhere. Yet. There is time for me to pray for a miracle."
He walks off in the direction of the fort, to the chapel. I listen to the men argue about how to shoot to kill the most gentlemen at once. Richard touches my arm. His eyes are bright. "Look," he whispers, pointing back behind us. At first I think I'm seeing a vision, that my imagination is playing tricks. I see a dozen native men emerging from the forest near the fort. Some are bare-chested despite the cold, and some have deerskin mantles thrown over one shoulder. They are walking quickly. There is one man among them who is not quite a native, though not quite a white man either. His hair is reddish-brown, but long and shaggy. He is wearing a deerskin mantle and also slops and shoes. Suddenly it is as if my eyes clear, and I know who I am seeing. "Captain Smith!" I cry, and run full speed to greet him. Everyone starts clamoring at once.
"They're leaving us!
They've stolen our food!
We've no stores left!
There's no good, lazy gentlemen!
We'll starve!
Where have you been?"
Captain Smith holds up his hand to silence us.
"Help me with the cannons," he orders.
We follow him to the fort, and our soldiers work to load the cannons and aim them squarely at the Discovery. Then Captain Smith marches down to the water's edge.
"Halt or be sunk,"
he shouts.
"Disembark at once or die."
We watch as the gentlemen on board the ship huddle and talk. After a few minutes of conferring with one another, Master Archer shouts out,
"Where are Jehu Robinson and Thomas Emery?"
Captain Smith shakes his head.
"Dead,"
he answers.
"Killed by the savages."
The gentlemen confer some more, and then begin to load the longboat with provisions to bring back to shore. A cheer goes up among the commoners. Our food is being returned to us, but I have an uneasy feeling. Why did the gentlemen change their minds as soon as Captain Smith told them that those two men are dead? I watch them paddle the longboat toward shore and think it almost feels too easy, this change in their plans. We turn our attention to Captain Smith with 100 questions.
"Where did you go? Why did you stay away so long? Did you bring corn? Did the Indians try to kill you?"
"Later," he says. "I will tell you all about it later."
The group of native men who have come with Captain Smith stand quietly watching as the gentlemen roll barrels of provisions up the river bank. Once the Discovery has been unmanned, Captain Smith turns back toward the fort.
"Payaquag,"
he says to the native men.
"That means to go with him," I say to Richard.
Richard and I follow too. Captain Smith brings the men to the fort, where two of our cannon sit perched on an artillery platform. He speaks to them in Algonquin as best he can.
"Here, guns I promise to Great Powhatan. You take to him."
My jaw drops open. We are forbidden to give the Indians muskets or swords, but Captain Smith is giving them cannons? The Indian men gather around one of the cannons to lift it. They strain, switch positions, team up, push and pull with all their might. Their faces turn red, veins on their necks stand out, and they sweat despite the icicles hanging from the trees. I glance over at Captain Smith and see that he is stifling a smile.
I give something easy for Carrie,
he offers. The would-be cannon carriers look relieved. They finally leave with handfuls of intricately colored glass beads, some bells, small mirrors, and a large copper pot. I wonder if the great Powhatan will be satisfied with the switch.
Now will you tell us where you've been?
John Layden asks. Did you really meet the great Powhatan? I ask.
Can't a man get breakfast before he has to give an oration? Captain Smith says.
Richard and I find the half-full barrel of corn and cook up a large pot of hominy. After breakfast, we keep the common cook fire going so we can warm ourselves while Captain Smith tells his story. Most of the common men come to listen. The gentlemen are, again, nowhere to be seen. Are they off sulking like scolded dogs, I wonder? Or hatching a new plan? But once Captain Smith begins his story, I don't give the gentleman another thought.
200 savages came upon me, he says. They captured me and took me prisoner. They paraded me from one village to another, and at each village there were ceremonies and dancing, with dancers painted red and black like fearsome devils. And there was feasting, lots of feasting. I was sure that as soon as I was fat enough for their liking, they would kill me and eat me.
I thought the Powhatans were not cannibals, I blurt out. Captain Smith shakes his head.
I didn't think so, but why else were they fattening me up?
He raises his eyebrows at me.
Finally, I was taken to the village of Werowocomoco. I was presented to Wahodsonacock, the great Powhatan himself. He sat on a throne covered with a large robe made of raccoon skins, with the tails still on. All around him sat his court, upwards of 200 men and women, their faces and shoulders painted red and crowns of white bird feathers on their heads. They had another feast, and then two large stones were brought and placed in front of Chief Powhatan.
Captain Smith pantomimes lifting two heavy stones.
Suddenly seven or eight warriors jumped up from their seats and seized me. They dragged me over and forced my head down on one of the stones. Three warriors stood over me with heavy clubs. They raised the clubs ready to bash my brains out.
I suck in my breath. Henry looks at me and rolls his eyes.
Well, he didn't get his brains bashed out now, did he?
He says. I glare at Henry and go back to listening.
There was no way for me to escape. With so many men holding me down, I could not even move,
Captain Smith says.
I prepared to die.
We are silent, waiting for the next turn in the story.
Suddenly I hear the voice of a child begging for my life to be spared. But Chief Powhatan refuses the requests. He declared, No, the Englishman will die. Then I saw who had been speaking. It was a little girl, about 9 or 10 years old. She came running over to me. She ignored the warriors with their raised clubs. She gathered my head in her arms and laid her own head down over mine. The warriors could not strike a blow now without hitting her first.
We are amazed by what we have heard. After a moment, Henry breaks the silence.
Oh, I don't believe it,
he says.
You made it all up, you did.
Captain Smith is on his feet in a second. He catches Henry up by the front of his shirt.
That little girl has more courage than you will ever have. And don't you ever call me a liar again.
Henry cowers.
Yes, sir,
he says. I want the story to continue. But just then President Ratcliffe, Master Malton, Master Archer, and a few of the other gentlemen come crowding into our circle. Several of them grab Captain Smith and hold him fast. We are too stunned to do anything.
What is going on here?
Captain Smith bellows. He thrashes at the men, but they jerk his arms behind his back, tie his hands together, and clamp chains around his ankles.
Stop this!
John Layden cries. He lifts his musket, but it is beaten out of his hands by Master Archer.
Watch yourself, or you'll face the gallows as well,
Master Archer warns. The gallows?
You are under arrest,
Master Archer announces.
The law of Leviticus states, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. You are responsible for the deaths of Thomas Emery and J.U. Robinson, as they were in your care. You will pay for those deaths with your life. Your execution will be at sunup tomorrow.
Captain Smith struggles, but he is tied so tightly hand and foot that he can hardly move.
You're mad,
he cries.
There is no English law that makes me responsible for those deaths.
But the gentlemen don't listen. They drag him away, his chains clanking. Rage bubbles up inside me. Without thinking, I snatch up a rock and hurl it straight at the back of Master Archer's head. Master Archer howls. He grabs his bleeding scalp and turns to look at us. I stand there, seething with anger. I feel the old urges, the desire to punch and rip, to see blood before my fury is spent. Captain Smith's voice speaks in my head.
Learn to channel your anger, Samuel, and it will become your strength rather than your weakness.
I know what they're doing, Henry is saying. They'll kill Captain Smith, and then they'll go ahead and sail away and leave us to starve.
Channel my anger? No, I can't stop myself. I run at Master Archer. I will knock him down and pummel the snot out of him.
Chapter 16. Great blame and imputation was laid upon me by them for the loss of our two men which the Indians slew, insomuch that they proposed to depose me. Captain John Smith, a true relation.
It is either Richard or God in his mercy who trips me. I sprawl on the ground, my face in the dirt.
Grab him!
Master Archer orders. Run! Richard cries. But before I can scramble to my feet, Reverend Hunt lifts me by one arm and holds me fast.
He is a boy,
he says slowly and firmly to Master Archer.
Leave him be. I will deal with him.
Master Archer wipes his bloody hand with his handkerchief. He gives me one last disgusted look, then turns to go. Reverend Hunt drags me with him to the chapel. Richard follows. I'm sorry, Reverend Hunt, I say as I struggle to keep up with his long strides. He is gripping my arm so tightly it hurts. He is focusing his anger, and most of that focus is going into my arm. He plops me down on a log bench in the chapel.
Do not leave until you have prayed long and hard. Pray to curb your temper. Pray for humility. You will need that desperately if you become the servant of one of the gentlemen.
I hop to my feet. I will not serve one of those men. They're criminals. Then I realize what he is saying. He is assuming that at sunup, Captain Smith will be hanged, and I will become another man's servant. Are you just going to let them kill him? I cry. Reverend Hunt rubs his temples.
I have no authority here,
he says quietly. I shake my head and sink back onto the log. Richard sits next to me. I had always assumed that Reverend Hunt held the highest authority, the authority of God.
Then can you pray for another miracle, Reverend? Richard asks.
Reverend Hunt looks up at him, his eyes bright for a moment. He nods.
Yes, he says. I will.
The three of us are quiet, lost in our own prayers. I pray to learn to curb my anger, but I do not ask for the humility to serve a new master. When we leave the chapel, we find the soldiers and laborers gathered at the cook fire. They are talking in hushed tones, their eyes shifting. We draw closer and hear their plan. There are a dozen gentlemen and over 20 of us. Yes, they have plenty of weapons, but we will have the element of surprise. Henry wants to simply slit the gentlemen's throats while they sleep.
but some of the others want an all-out battle. A war. Reverend Hunt scowls.
No, no killing, he says. A war amongst ourselves will be the end of us. An end to the colony. We will not even have enough men left to fend off an Indian attack.
But the men ignore him. They want blood. And if it will save Captain Smith, so do I. I grow weary of listening to the men argue about their plans. I nudge Richard, and we leave to walk down to the river. The afternoon sun is low. A breeze has lifted, and the river has ripples over its surface.
Do you think their plans will work? Richard asks me.
I shake my head. A lot of men will die. Maybe you and I will die. And yet, if we do nothing, we both know what will happen tomorrow morning. We will watch Captain Smith climb up the ladder to the gallows, watch them slip the noose around his neck. When they shove him off the ladder, the weight of his body will jerk his neck against the noose. Our only hope will be for his neck to break quickly, so that death will come mercifully. I have seen hangings where a man gurgles and thrashes and his face turns red, and death comes so slowly that I have wished for a sword to put him out of his agony. A thin layer of ice has crusted over the water along the shoreline. I press on it with the toe of my shoe until it breaks like glass, making a star of thin lines. The wind is stiff now and chills me right through my clothes. When I first heard about the Roanoke colony disappearing, I wondered how it could have happened so quickly. Yet here we are, down to fewer than 40 men from 105, and about to kill one another off. I sit down heavily on the river bank. Something on the horizon, downriver, catches my attention. I blink, then rub my eyes. It is a ship. The low winter sun has turned her sails to gold, and she is gliding toward us in the wind. My mouth goes dry. Is this the Spanish ship we have been dreading, come to attack and kill us all? They will have an easy task. Can you see her flag yet? I ask slowly. Not yet, says Richard. His eyes are on the approaching ship as well. A vulture circles overhead. Then I see it, the sun catching it just right to show us the blue, white, and red. It's an English ship, I shout. Could it be Captain Newport after all this time? Richard cries. Reverend Hunt's words echo in my head. I have no authority here. But Captain Newport does have authority here, and I am sure he will not let them hang Captain Smith. I strain my neck, trying to see. Who is on board? Is there a one-armed man? The ship glides closer. Shouldn't we go tell them a ship is here? Richard asks. Not until I see who the captain is, I say. I want to know if Captain Smith is saved. Then I see him, standing at the bow, looking toward shore. The one-armed captain of the ship. Richard and I take off running up the hill to the fort. You did it, Reverend Hunt! I shout at the top of my lungs. You got your miracle!
Chapter 17. The country is excellent, and very rich in gold and copper. Of the gold we have brought to Say, an ore sample which proved worthless, and hope to be with your lordship shortly to show it, His Majesty and the rest of the lords. Captain Christopher Newport, from a letter to the Lord of Salisbury.
Captain Newport brings so many changes, it nearly makes our heads spin. Captain Smith is freed, and Master Archer is taken off the council. Our cabins are suddenly crowded with 60 new colonists, and the fort becomes noisy with several new dogs, a dozen hogs, and enough chickens to coat the ground of the whole fort with their droppings. He also brings a new boy, Thomas Savage. The men tease him because of his name,
He is a savage, they say. Send him to live with the savages.
Our storehouse is filled to overflowing with the good things the ship has brought. Wheat, pork, ale, wine, butter, and beef. We eat very well, and since this puts everyone in a good mood, there is no more talk about stealing away to England. There is a fragile peace between the gentlemen, who are willing to kill us by starvation, and us commoners, who are ready to murder them in their beds. It is a good thing we have the 60 new men and boys to help buffer our smouldering anger toward one another. A few days after Captain Newport arrives, we hear shouts of, "Wingapo!" and look to see Indians paddling to shore in three canoes.
"Wingapo, Captain Smith,"
they call. When the canoes land and the Indian men begin to pull them up on shore, Richard and I go closer. The canoes are filled with bread, fish, and meat, turkey, squirrel, deer, and raccoon. "We don't even need to trade for food," I say to Richard. "We've got so much in the storehouse now that the ship is here." But Richard's eyes are wide, fixed on something. I follow his gaze. In one of the canoes sits a little girl. She has straight black hair, cut very short on the front and sides, and fastened in a long braid down her back. She wears several necklaces of pearls and copper, and a mantle of deerskin over one shoulder. As we watch, she jumps out of the canoe and trots up to Captain Smith. She is fairly skipping with excitement at seeing him. I hear some of what she says as she speaks to him in Algonquin. "I bring gifts from my father, now that you are my countrymen." "The food is not for trade? It is being delivered as a gift?" It suddenly occurs to me who this must be. I grab Richard's arm. "It's her," I whisper. "I know," Richard whispers back. We watch her as she talks to Captain Smith. She's only a child. Captain Smith says she is about 10 years old, but in my mind she has become like a goddess. She is Chief Powhatan's daughter, the girl who saved Captain Smith's life, the Indian princess who has more courage than 100 soldiers. Suddenly, to my surprise, I hear Captain Smith say in his clumsy Algonquin,
"Come meet boys. They show you my home."
My stomach does a little flip as Captain Smith leads her over to Richard and me. He tells her our names. I watch her happy dark eyes and keep telling myself she is only a child, no one to be so awestruck about.
"And this is Amanut,"
Captain Smith says to me and Richard.
"But she is called Playful One, Pocahontas."
Pocahontas grins. "Come and show me Captain Smith's home," she says. I translate for Richard, and he nods enthusiastically. I point to our palisades. "Home, there," I say in Algonquin. It is my first time trying out my newly learned words on a native speaker, and when she understands, it feels like magic. Pocahontas runs up the hill, nimble as a deer on her bare feet. Richard and I follow. I always thought that princesses were supposed to be quiet and proper, and sit around looking royal. Not this princess. Pocahontas peeks inside the fort gates. The men on guard look at her and raise their eyebrows. "She's the daughter of Chief Powhatan," I tell them. Pocahontas whips her head around when she hears her father's name. Then she runs to one of our cabins to look in the door. "This is Captain Smith's house?" she asks. "No," I shake my head. "Payaquag," I say, and motion for her to follow me. I lead her to the cabin Captain Smith shares with Reverend Hunt, the carpenter John Layden, and several other men. She is fascinated with the cabin and with Captain Smith's belongings. Like a typical child, she wants to touch everything, and because she is a princess, Richard and I don't dare stop her. She sits on one of the beds and jostles it, listening to the straw crackle. She grins at herself in the shaving mirror. She looks at the muskets leaning against the wall and gives them a wide berth. I realize Captain Smith must have demonstrated his firepower to her tribe. When she sees Reverend Hunt's Bible, she opens it and gently touches the pages. I wonder if it is the first book she has ever seen. When she goes to pick up a straight razor, Richard gasps. I reach to pull it away. Sharp, I say loudly in Algonquian. Bad. She gives me a mischievous look, takes the blade, and runs it quickly across her arm. Richard cries, No! I yelp and lunge for her. I grab the blade out of her hand. Richard grasps her arm. Quick! Get Doc Wharton! He yells. But Pocahontas just giggles. When we inspect her arm, there is no cut at all. She has played a trick on us. Can you run fast? She asks, as if she has not just scared the living daylights out of us. Yes, I say. Running is something I've always been good at. She is asking me how fast I can run, I tell Richard. She leads us outside the cabin. She takes me by the shoulders and makes me stand facing down the main lane that goes through the center of our fort. Then she stands Richard beside me, facing the same way. We will race, she announces. It is a warm winter day, as warm as a spring day in England, and around the fort men are outside, working on everything from repairing wattle and daub walls to shucking corn. They watch in amusement as we prepare for our race. To the wall, she says. I explain to Richard that we are about to race to the palisade wall. He nods in approval. Pocahontas readies herself next to Richard. She counts with her fingers. Kneecut, ning, nuss! We run full speed down the lane, with dogs chasing and chickens squawking as they fly out of our way. I win by just a bit. Pocahontas's face glows with sweat. You do run fast, she says. But I am faster. I tripped on my mantle. And with that, she pulls off her mantle. She has nothing on underneath, but she seems to not even notice that she is naked. We will race again, she says. I will win this time. We line up again. I am not so ready to let a 10-year-old girl beat me. Pocahontas counts. Kneecut, ning, nuss! I pump my legs as fast as they will go. But this time, freed of her mantle, Pocahontas wins easily. You just got beat by a girl, Richard teases. I grumble, but Pocahontas is already on to her next idea. Can you do this? She asks, and she wheels herself hand to hand and foot to foot like a cartwheel. I try to imitate her, but I end up falling on my bum. Pocahontas laughs and shows us again. Richard copies her and actually does quite well. When I try again, I fall on my hip and elbow, but then I start to get the hang of it. Thomas Savage sees what we are doing and comes to join us. Soon we are all able to do the cartwheels. The men look up from their work to watch us, three English boys in dirty shirts and worn-out slops, and one naked Indian princess, tumbling like cartwheels all over the fort. Captain Newport tells us that the soil and rocks we sent back to England were just that, dirt and rocks. There was no gold in them at all. But the Virginia Company still wants gold, and Captain Newport is convinced we can find it for them. And so, early on a frosty morning, just a week or so after the ship has arrived, a group of men gathers buckets, picks, and shovels, and sets off in search of gold to send back to England. They leave their cabins with their nighttime fires still burning. Someone from one of the cabins must have left a shirt draped over a chair near the embers, or a Bible on a table too close to the flames. Someone, somewhere. We never did find out where the fire started.
Fire!
Someone shouts,
and I look to see orange flames leap from one thatched roof to another. I snatch up a bucket and race through the river, but by the time I get back, more cabins have caught fire. Flames lick their way down the palisade, spreading like spilled wine. Men stumble through the smoke, trying to find the front gate of the fort. A soldier comes running at me, his clothes aflame. He grabs my bucket and empties the water over his head. His shirt sizzles and he gasps, slapping at the burned fabric. I return to the river, fill my bucket again. Captain Smith is there, shouting, ordering the men into a line.
"Pass the buckets, hand to hand,"
he yells. We form a line that stretches from the river to the fort, and we pass the buckets quickly, one to another. Flames leap, and thick black smoke engulfs the entire fort. One side of the palisade buckles and falls.
"Save the palisade!"
someone cries. I see the men at the fort throwing bucket after bucket onto the burning posts. The wind blows smoke toward us, and it makes me cough. Cinders and bits of ash swirl in the air. I think of nothing except passing the buckets of water until my fingers are blistering and my arms ache. So much work. So many weeks we spent cutting trees, splitting clapboard, tying thatch, making wattle and daub. It is all turning to ashes before our eyes. It is afternoon before we finally quell the flames. We manage to save a good part of the palisade, but the houses are virtually gone, along with everything in them. Even Reverend Hunt's Bible is lost in the blaze, and worst of all, the storehouse and all the food in it has been destroyed. Chapter 18. You did promise Powhatan what was yours should be his, and he the like to you. You called him father, being in his land a stranger, and by the same reason so must I do you. And fear you here, I should call you father? I tell you then I will, and you shall call me child. And so I will be forever and ever your countryman.
Pocahontas speaking to Captain John Smith, when they met in England in the year 1616 or 1617. Quoted by Smith in the General History.
When I lived on the streets of London, I was a loner. It was me against the world. But coming here to Jamestown has changed me. I have learned to depend on others, especially Reverend Hunt, Captain Smith, and even Richard. I have learned the importance of standing together, of cooperating. My circle has become bigger. Now this fire has changed all of us. Our houses, our food, even our blankets and extra clothing are gone. And it has turned cold, bone-chilling winter cold. And yet, we have not all starved or frozen to death. Instead, our circle has become bigger. The day after the fire, Pocahontas comes again with several men from her tribe. They have seen the smoke and are here to see if we are all right. Pocahontas runs to where Captain Smith's cabin used to be. I follow her. She stands among the ashes, bends down, and sifts through a pile of burnt wood. Then she stands and looks at me. Her eyes brim with tears. "It is all gone," she says. "Captain Smith's house, his bed, his mirror, his beard-cutting knife, all gone." I nod. She blinks and tears run down her cheeks. She wipes them quickly away. "Captain Smith is now my brother, my countryman. My father will send gifts to help." She says it with such authority that I am reminded that she is not just a little girl, but a princess. The Powhatan people, whom we have at times considered our enemies, now treat us as their own. They bring us deerskins and bear furs to keep us warm. Every few days they come in canoes, laden with meat and bread and corn as gifts.
We start to rebuild right away, with everyone working hard. We make the fort bigger, giving it 3 new walls where the 1 wall fell down, and making it 5-sided. We begin again to build houses. January stretches into February, and it turns even colder. The night air sucks the warmth from our bones as we try to sleep in tents made from the ship's sails. Without the skins and furs from the Powhatans, we would all freeze. As it is, we sometimes awake in the morning to find one of our men, the oldest, weakest, and sickest among us, frozen in his bed. And once again, digging graves is part of my regular chores. We make a very interesting trade. We send Thomas Savage to Werowocomoco to live, and Chief Powhatan sends us his servant boy, Namantak, to live with us. Our circles widen even more, and I think it is a good way to live. We are standing on many legs now, together with the Powhatans. I think of the centipedes that used to crawl over my bed last summer, and I think we are like them with so many legs. A centipede does not topple in a storm. Namantak, our new tentmate, is 14 years old, or 14 returns of the leaf, as he puts it. Because he is a servant, he wears no copper or pearls. In fact, he wears no mantle even in the cold weather, only leggings and breechcloth. Namantak has bright eyes and a quick smile. He is taller than I am, and strong-looking too. I certainly wouldn't want to race him. I'm sure he would beat me by a mile. Reverend Hunt says it is very good that Namantak has come to live with us. The Reverend has been impatient to win the souls of the natives for Christ.
"We will teach the boy English," Reverend Hunt says, "and then I will tell him the good news of Christ, and he will bring that message to his people."
And so Reverend Hunt spends each morning teaching Namantak a few English words. Namantak teaches me more Algonquin words as we work alongside each other with the house building, and I am getting much better at the language. One day we are splitting clapboard, and he shakes his head.
"Our houses are better," he says in Algonquin.
He has been telling me almost daily what things are better at his home, and so I am not surprised.
"We do not take big trees down to build our houses."
He goes on to tell me how their houses are built with frames made of thin saplings. The walls and roofs are made of mats woven from rushes. He says they are much warmer than our drafty houses. I try to imagine his village, Werowocomoco, and hope that soon I will be allowed on one of Captain Smith's exploration trips so that I'll see an Indian village for myself. Namantak shakes his head again and frowns.
"Our tribe is better than your tribe," he says. "Your tribe has no women. I do not understand why Chief Powhatan brought you into the Powhatan Empire. A tribe with no women and children is not worth much."
My jaw drops. "Us in Powhatan Empire?" I ask in my halting Algonquin.
"Yes,"
Namantak says, with the patience one uses when explaining something to a small child.
"Captain Smith was adopted into our tribe. He became a son to Chief Powhatan. Captain Smith is your ruler, your werowance, and so now your tribe belongs to Chief Powhatan. You are Powhatan people. What happens to one of us happens to all of us. That is why we took care of you after the fire."
"Captain Smith adopted?" I squeak. Namantak nods.
"He died as an Englishman and came back to life as a Powhatan man."
I picture Captain Smith, his head held down on a rock, with men ready to bash his brains out. Or were they? Pocahontas make Captain Smith know death? I struggle to find the words to ask my question.
"Yes, yes," Namantak says, grinning.
I am relieved. So they really did almost kill Captain Smith. But then Namantak adds,
Pocahontas was perfect at the ceremony. Chief Powhatan chose her to save Captain Smith, because she is his favorite among all his daughters.
I bury my face in my hands. It was theater, a ritual. They are acting out death and rebirth, and Pocahontas was part of an act. Namantak asks me what is wrong. Why am I holding my head in my hands? I tell him I am just tired. Now it all makes sense. The gifts of food and animal furs, the sudden peace between us. Chief Powhatan is taking care of us because he considers us one of his tribes. If it were just me, I would be very happy with the arrangement. It means survival and peace. It means an end to the bloodshed between our settlers and the Powhatans. But I know these gentlemen, and I know they have no interest in being the subjects of a man they consider to be a lowly savage. I also know that President Ratcliffe would be quite surprised to find out that Chief Powhatan thinks Captain Smith is our real ruler. My hope is that, with no one to explain it to them, the gentlemen simply won't find out that Powhatan now considers us his subjects. By spring, we have dug a well for clean, fresh water. We have also built enough houses for everyone, and a new church for Reverend Hunt to hold our daily services in. Captain Newport's ship is again loaded with rocks that we hope contain gold. I have not totally given up on my dream of riches from this new world, but those hopes have certainly dimmed. The ship also carries 3 new passengers. Master Wingfield and Master Archer are being sent back to England in dishonor, and Namantak is going to England so that he can come back and tell Chief Powhatan all about it. Namantak shows me a stick Chief Powhatan has given him.
"I will count the people and make marks on the stick," he says. "I will be able to tell Chief Powhatan how many people there are in your land."
I laugh, remembering the teeming streets of London, with carriages and horses and people and hogs all vying for space on the cobblestones. I think of Namantak walking along the docks, the same docks I left so many months ago, and seeing our world for the first time. I wonder what he will think of St. Paul's Church, with its pinnacles and tower rising high as Virginia trees, or the rows and rows of wattle and daub houses with gangs of dirty children playing out front. How the English will stare at him with his deerskin breechcloth and bare chest. I think he will need many, many sticks to count all the people in England, but I don't tell him so. I say goodbye and wish him a safe voyage. The summer of 1608 is much better than the summer of 1607. We now have fresh water from our well, houses for everyone instead of tents, and peace with the natives. Captain Smith continues our trading, so food is plentiful. Still, a sickness comes upon us. We now call it the summer sickness, and many of our men are too weak to work. There are the usual conjectures about what it can be, the usual suspicion that there is a Spanish spy among us who is slipping ratsbane into our food and drink. But Reverend Hunt says he thinks it has something to do with the mosquitoes. We get sick as soon as they start to buzz and bite. One day, while Captain Smith is away on an exploration trip up the river, President Ratcliffe makes a decision that cost him his presidency. He decides he wants a large house in the woods, a house befitting a president. And then the lot of us, hot, itchy, feverish men and boys, will build it for him. He forces us to work with the threat of whipping if we refuse. By the time Captain Smith returns, a week later, and finds out what is going on, we are angry as a nest of hornets.
"He's worse than Wingfield," Henry shouts.
"He's been eating more than his share of the stores and lying idle while we sweat and faint in the heat," Nathaniel complains.
"He's unfit to be president," John Leyden declares.
There is more angry discussion, and by the end of the day it is decided.
Captain Ratcliffe will no longer be our president. He will be sent back to England with the next supply ship. Then the debate begins about who should be our new president. It must be a man who cares about the whole colony, not just himself and a few friends. They want someone who is fair and willing to do his share of the work, not sit idle giving orders. They want someone who has been here since the beginning, who knows about how to survive in Virginia. When they make their choice, I am amazed and proud. Captain John Smith will be our new president. Chapter 19.
You must obey this now for a law, that he that will not work shall not eat, except by sickness he be disabled. For the labors of 30 or 40 honest and industrious men shall not be consumed to maintain 150 idle loiterers. Captain John Smith, quoted in William Simons, E.D., The Proceedings.
On September 10th, 1608, Captain John Smith takes the oath of office and becomes our new president. He officially decrees,
"He that will not work shall not eat,"
and he holds us to it. Gentleman or not, any man who wants supper has to pitch in. But even with this decree, he is well liked. Unlike Presidents Wingfield and Ratcliffe before him, Captain Smith divides the rations equally with us and works right alongside us, sharing the burdens too. And he stays in the cabin he has always shared with Reverend Hunt, John Leyden, and others. There will be no mansion in the woods for President Smith. There are a few gentlemen left from the group who try to run off on the discovery with our food, and I sometimes hear grumbling from them, but they are far outnumbered now by men, new settlers and old, who have great respect and trust for Captain Smith. So now I am the page of a ruler. It is the most important I have ever felt in my life. I wish my mum could know, and I hope she does know, taking a peek down from heaven now and then. She would also be very surprised to see that a commoner is our president. I think it would make her happy to know that here in the New World, the gentlemen don't hold all of the power. Captain Smith continues to write our story. He is also drawing maps of the rivers and land he has found on his exploration trips. I am relieved to find out that not all of his writings were destroyed in the fire. Some of the pages had already been sent back to England with Captain Newport. One day in late September, Richard and I are in the field harvesting vegetables. We have grown them in the way Namantak taught us, planting the corn and beans together in a mound, so that the bean plants can climb the corn stalks. Suddenly we hear shouts from the river front.
"Ship ashore!"
And a few moments later,
"She flies the British flag!"
Richard and I stop working and look at each other. "Could it be Captain Newport so soon?" Richard asks. I look at the baskets of beans and squash we've already gathered. I hope we've done enough work to earn our supper, and that no one will mind if we go to greet the ship. "Let's go see," I say. Other men come to the riverfront as well. We watch as the ship glides toward shore. Captain Newport is at her helm.
"Another crowd of colonists to feed, no doubt," Henry grumbles.
"Let's hope they've sent us more skilled workers and fewer gentlemen, as I requested," says President Smith.
The ship anchors, the longboat is lowered, and the first few passengers begin to climb down the rope ladder. The late afternoon sun glints in my eyes, and at first I think that what I am seeing is a trick of the light. But then I hear the men around me, as amazed as I am.
"Could it be?"
"My lord, it's a vision!"
"How could they send women to this godforsaken place?"
As the longboat nears us, men trip over one another, rushing to help.
"Let me give her a hand." "No, let me give her a hand."
I'm surprised we don't have a fist fight before the longboat even lands. In the boat are a number of men, but all any of us see are the two women, sitting straight-backed, clutching satchels. One of the women is older, and large, with a round face and double chin. The other woman, a girl really, has pale skin and dark, frightened eyes. A few black curls peek out from under her coif. I listen to the conversation as the longboat passengers are introduced to President Smith. Master Francis West. Master Daniel Tucker. Master and Mrs. Thomas Forrest. And Mrs. Forrest's servant girl, Anne Burras. It has been a very long time since we have seen English women. It gives me a twinge of sadness, of missing my mother, to see their colourful petticoats, indigo blue and saffron yellow, and white coifs. It feels familiar, like home. Miss Anne Burras squints her eyes, scowls, and ignores the men who are jostling one another to have a chance to carry her satchel. She holds tight to that satchel and turns her back to them. I feel sorry for her, being the centre of attention like that, when she obviously doesn't want to be. Nomentak is on the next longboat trip to shore. I am surprised to see that he is wearing a linen shirt. But England did not change him too much. His hair is still shaved close on one side and long on the other, and his eyes are still bright. He beams at me. "Hello, Samuel. How are you?" he calls out in accented English. "I am now a world traveller." I laugh. "You are speaking English well, my friend," I call to him. I realize that in his months away, with no one to speak Algonquin with, he has had plenty of time to learn the English language, much more than the few words and phrases Reverend Hunt taught him before he left. "Nomentak, where is your stick?" I ask. "Did you make lots of notches in it?" Nomentak shakes his head. "Too many people," he says. "I throw stick in river." Reverend Hunt is very happy that Nomentak is now speaking English so well. He wastes no time, but sits him down to tell him about God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and how he must bring the message of salvation to the other Powhatans. Nomentak nods enthusiastically. "Yes, yes, I learn of your gods in England, and I tell them of my gods." He launches into a lively description of Okius, the vengeful god who requires sacrifices of tobacco, copper, beads, and sometimes animal blood, and sends punishment if he is not made happy. He tells us about Ahon, the god who is all-loving, all-forgiving, who makes the sun shine and ripens the crops. And he tells us of the great respect his people have for the spirit of life that is in all things, people, animals, plants, fire, water, wind. Reverend Hunt shakes his head. "There is only one God, maker of heaven and earth." Reverend Hunt tells us the story of creation, how God made the world and all things in it in 6 days, and rested on the seventh day, the Sabbath. Again, Nomentak nods with interest. "Now I tell you how our world was made," he says. He tells us a story about the great hare who created different kinds of men and women and put them in a big sack. He protected them from giants who wanted to eat them. The great hare filled the rivers with fish and put deer upon the land. Then he took the men and women out of the sack and put them in different places on the earth to live. I enjoy Nomentak's story, but I can see that Reverend Hunt is becoming discouraged. Nomentak does not understand that he is to give up his gods and his stories and take the word of God from the Bible back to his people. Reverend Hunt begins to explain again, but Captain Smith finds us boys sitting idle and tells Reverend Hunt he needs us to come work in the gardens. I put on my straw hat and pick up a basket. I hope Reverend Hunt is not too disappointed that his first time trying to convert
a Virginia native to Christianity, did not work out. Captain Newport has brought us 70 new colonists, stores, and the news that the rocks we sent to England were, once again, just rocks. The Virginia Company has a new idea about how we can make a profit. We are to use the raw materials we have here in Virginia and begin making glass, pitch, tar, and soap ashes to send back to England. They've sent us several Polish and German tradesmen to get us started with these projects. They have already begun to build a glass house a little way from our fort, with a large furnace for glass making. Captain Newport has also brought orders from the Virginia Company to place an English crown on Chief Powhatan's head, making him a prince under King James, and making all of his people English subjects. My mind reels when I hear this. Chief Powhatan thinks we are his subjects, and now they want to make Powhatan's people English subjects? The whole thing tangles my brain in knots. If the thought of being Chief Powhatan's subjects would be distasteful to the gentlemen, then I imagine that becoming subjects of King James would be just as distasteful to the Powhatan people, especially after they hear Namantak's report on King James, whom he met while he was in London.
"Our Chief Powhatan is much better than your king," Namantak says, speaking in Algonquin so that the gentlemen will not hear his assessment of our exalted king. "Your king is a short, weak man. Our chief is tall and very strong. Your king has no hair and no teeth, just a round belly from eating too much. How can such a man be king?"
A look of disgust crosses Namantak's face, as if he is not quite sure how to tell me his next point.
"And he stinks. Does he not bathe? And he drinks wine until he can no longer speak or stand."
I have heard these stories about our King James. It is well known that the king's doctors have warned him that bathing causes the plague, and he has taken this advice to heart. He only